If you've got an order of service, you'll see on the right-hand side of the inside of the order of service these words from Ruth, the book of Ruth in the Old Testament. I'm going to read it. I'm also going to take off my tie and open my collar because it's tight. Hope that offends no one. So I'm going to read, this is words taken from the book of Ruth in the Old Testament, the first 14 verses of that first chapter. This is God's word. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn or stay in the country of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi, and the name of his sons was Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. And she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah, the name of the other Ruth. They lived there about 10 years. And Mahlon and Chilion died. So that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughter-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return, each of you, to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them and left, lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet in my womb that they may become your husband, or sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. I want to preach the next three evenings, and I trust you will be able to come back each of the next two evenings. This is Wednesday, tomorrow night and Friday night, and then twice on Sunday. And I've chosen to consider this theme of from heartache to joy. And I want to look at it as it is presented to us in the book of Ruth. Now, the book of Ruth is a very short book. It's a very engaging book. And there are a couple of reasons why it is so engaging. The first is because it's about ordinary people in everyday situations. And the second reason why it's so engaging is because about two-thirds of this short book is dialogue. It's conversation. And so we are peering in here to conversations that are being had between people like ourselves. A lot of the Old Testament and God's gracious providence is an account of his loving dealings with the nation of Israel. It begins after the initial chapters in Genesis. It begins with the account of God speaking to a man called Abraham, telling him to move from his place of where he's living in Haran and moving to another land to set up home. And then it follows the history of that family as that family grows and gets bigger until it becomes a nation of more than 2 million people. It follows it through a great, powerful stage in the history of its existence, and then through the period of decline. And often we read about the account of that nation. We're reading about the nation, the kings. We're reading about rulers. We're reading about national affairs, affairs of state. This book doesn't operate on that level. We're not looking at the affairs of state. We're not looking at the great exploits of kings or princes or rulers. We're not looking at the expanse of what happens in a nation. What we're going to be looking at in these nights and on Sunday is the experience of one family. One family. It tells us about the moves the family make from one place to another place. It speaks about the marriages that take place in the family. It speaks about the deaths that occur in the family. It speaks about the relationship between a mother-in-law and her two daughters. It speaks about separation, about loneliness, about struggles and difficulties and hurts. It speaks about love and care and kindness. It speaks about hard work and commitment. It speaks about good decisions made. And in the end, it speaks about real joy. So in other words, this journey from heartache to joy is a journey that we're going to explore that is real. The people we're going to read about are not hypothetical. They're not storyline characters. They really did exist. Their experiences were real. Their hurts were real. Their difficulties were real. Their marriages were real. The deaths were real. The separations were real. The loneliness was real. These things that pervaded their lives and permeate our lives were real. And so when we walk along this journey from heartache to joy, we can identify with it because it was real. It was real. We can identify with it because it happened to real people. We can identify with it because we will see some of the experiences that they experienced in our own lives and the lives of people that we know. And this is a journey that should intrigue us. For who of us doesn't experience heartache, and who of us doesn't want to taste joy? Is there any of you tonight, even the youngest of you, who can say, I've never experienced any hurt in my life? And is there any of us tonight who wouldn't say, I want to experience real joy. Not just circumstantial happiness. Not just the happiness that comes with things and the happiness that comes with a good day. But that sort of deep, inner, real peace and contentment. That unspeakable joy that carries through regardless of the experience, regardless of the hurt, regardless of the circumstances. Now, I want to point out from the very beginning that this isn't a story about self-help. In fact, the reality is that real joy can't be self-attained. There's nothing that you and I can do to attain to self-engendered joy. Many of us have tried it. We've tried in many different ways to find that joy in and of ourselves. We've followed down many avenues and we've come up short every single time. Yes, there have been seasons when we've been happy, we've been on a bit of a high. But we always come back down to earth with a thud. This real joy, this true joy, this genuine joy is not something that we can self-generate. Real joy in life. And here's the secret to this whole experience of this next few nights. Real joy, true joy, real peace, true contentment can only be found through a relationship with God. And only God can give us that real joy. Only God can give us that real peace. Only God can give us that real contentment. It's not about changing our circumstances. It's not about fixing the issues in our lives. It's about addressing the reality of the need of God in our life. And I'm going to explore that and bring that to you tonight, because if you've come here tonight and you're searching for this joy out of real heartache, I don't want to feed you a self-help lie. I don't want to say to you, come to this church and we will make you happy. I don't want to say to you, come here on Sunday and all your woes will be dealt with, because they won't be dealt with, because we cannot deal with them. Those of us who come to this church week by week are fully aware of our own limitedness when it comes to actually enabling ourselves to find this joy in our own lives. All that we can do is to point you to the source of this joy. All we can do is to ask God to reveal the reality of your need to Him, of Him, and then facilitate your meeting of Him. So I want to begin our study of this short book this evening by considering the events recorded in the passage that we read in the opening 14 verses. And I want to look at the background to the heartache. The background to the heartache, and then I want to look at the first stage to the joy. This heartache was real. What was the background to it? What then was the first stage on the journey to joy? The very first verse, and I would encourage you to open up your order of service and look at that verse, because I'm going to be working through this. It's from God's Word, and that's the important thing. And we're going to see in this section that there are two dimensions to this heartache. There's a national heartache and there's a personal heartache. There's a heartache that comes from going on, what's going on in the nation, and then there's a heartache that comes to them in their own lives. And the first verse tells us, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And that tells us that this family lived at a very disruptive time in the history of Israel. Israel was basically a nation comprising different tribes. They had no central structure of government. And it was plagued. The nation of Israel was plagued. It was plagued by a failure of the people of Israel to live their lives the way that God had told them to live it. God had brought them out of a situation of 400 years of slavery. And then he had brought them into this new land, and God had been very honest with them, and God said to them, I'm bringing you this into this land, and here's how I want you to love me, and here's how I want you to love each other. He'd spelled it out for them. He'd sent men along to teach them that. He'd sent prophets to guide them in that. He'd given them actual rules. And he says to them, here are the rules that I want you to follow. Not because I'm dictatorial. Not because I want to be brutal in my exercise of rule over you. But he says, I love you. I love you. And because I love you, I want you to do what I say. Because I know you better than you know yourselves. Because I have made you. And I know how you think. And I know what makes you tick. I know what you like. I know what you don't like. I know your attitudes. I know your actions. And God says, I love you, and I want you to walk in this way. I want you to think about this, and I want you to observe this love for me, and I want you to observe this love for each other. And if you do that, if you love me the way that I ask you to, and you love each other and respect each other in the way in which I ask you to, then life will be good. But if you don't, it'll be hard. It'll be difficult. You will experience the consequence of that. You don't have it before you, but in the last verse of the book before Ruth, the book of Judges, let me read it to you. This is what it says. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we know from what it says in that book and the books that precede it, that rather than loving God, these people had decided that as well as loving God, they were going to love the gods of the nation and the nations that surrounded them. They weren't content with loving God. They said, certainly we can love God some of the time, but these other gods are important as well, and we should love them. And so they worship them. They engaged in idolatry. Now, sometimes we think of idolatry, and we think of idolatry as bowing down before a little statue. But idolatry really is giving your love to anything before your love for God. Idolatry is giving anything priority in your life over loving God. And God had said to these people, I have loved you. I have entered into a promise to love you. I have provided for you. I have protected you. And he demonstrated that through 40 years of wilderness wandering when he fed them every day. And he meant that they kept that their shoes didn't wear out and their clothes didn't wear out. He demonstrated that. And when he brought them into the land that he'd promised them, he destroyed the peoples who were in that land. He gave them homes that they didn't have to build. He gave them vineyards they didn't have to plant. Olive groves that they spent no time cultivating. God had given them stuff over and over and over and over and over again. And God had demonstrated his love for them. And all God said to them was, love me. But they decided they would love God plus other gods. Well, God doesn't do love plus other gods. He's not interested in that. God's not interested in partial love, just as you are not interested in partial love. You're not interested in partial love. You want someone to love you entirely. You don't want someone to love you and then love someone else and love someone else and love someone else and love someone else. Those of you who are women who are married, you want your husband to love you. You don't want him to come home of an evening and you say to him, "Well, how was your day? Well, I told so-and-so at work that she was really beautiful and I really enjoyed having my lunch with her. And I wouldn't mind this evening if we went out to the pictures together." You'll not mind. I know you've worked all day doing my washing and my ironing. I know you've appreciated that. And I know you've made this meal. And I know that you're going to do these dishes. But I'm going to go out with her tonight. That'll be all right. I don't think that you would honestly say, "Well, that's okay. Have a good time. And here's a fiver to buy her some sweets when you're out." You see, we want to be loved entirely for who we are. Well, God is no different. And these people didn't love God with all their hearts. They loved God when it suited them. But when it didn't suit them, they would love other gods. Things that were more tangible. Things that they could see. Things that they could touch. Things that they could smell. Things that they felt were more real because the people around them looked at those and said these gods were real. When in reality, those gods could give them nothing. Because they didn't exist. And in terms of their relationships with each other, God had said, "I want you to love one another. I want you to have moral relationships with each other. I want you to care for one another." And they again had demonstrated by their dealings with one another that that wasn't what they were doing. Constantly in the book that precedes the book of Ruth, we read almost in every chapter, the people did evil in the Lord's eyes. They did evil in the Lord's eyes. The consequence of that was very direct. We read in verse 1, there was a famine in the land. A famine in the land. We don't know what the origin of this famine was. But in Judges chapter 6, and let me read you a few verses from Judges chapter 6. The people of God, Israel, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. Midian was another nation. And the hand of Midian overpowered Israel, and because of Midian, the people of Israel made for themselves the dens that are in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. For whenever the Israelites planted crops, the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. They would encamp against them, devour the produce of the land as far as Gaza, and leave no sustenance in Israel, no sheep, no ox, or no donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents. They would come like locusts in number. Both they and their camels could not be counted, so that they laid waste to the land as they came in. And Israel was brought very low because of Midian. They refused to do what God said, and there was a consequence. There's a famine in the land. The famine in the land is the product of God withholding his hand. It's a product of judgment. The nation is in heartache. The nation is in heartache. In another chapter in Judges, we read the people were greatly distressed. In terrible distress. In terrible distress. So this family is living in a nation that isn't right. There's a lot of things going wrong in the nation. People are not loving God. People are not loving each other. Everyone is doing what is right in his own eyes. People are being exploited. not a good environment. And then we come to the personal heartache. The personal heartache. We read that Elimelech, this is the family, we're introduced to them now, verse 2, and his wife Naomi, and they have two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. They're from Bethlehem, and they leave the nation of Israel, the region of Judah, and they cross over to Moab. Now, you've got Judah here, you've got the Dead Sea here, and then you've got Moab. As a nation, Moab was not a region into which the people of God should have gone. The relationship between Israel and the Moabites was not good. God said to Israel that they shouldn't allow any Moabite to come into their assembly, because when he was bringing them out of the slavery in Egypt, the Moabites, who were distant cousins, had refused to feed them and care for them. In fact, the Moabites had set up an attack against them. And God said, I brought the Israelites out of Egypt, and they were vulnerable and they were in need. And the Moabites should have cared for them and looked after them. But instead of caring for them and looking after them, they treated them harshly. And God says, because they treated them harshly, then in the future no Moabite will be welcome into the assembly of the household of Israel. And there's also evidence in the book of Ezra that the writer of the book of Ezra says that the problems that later befell the nation of Israel was because many of them, the Israelites, intermarried with the Moabites, and the Moabite impact on their lives was a disaster. So when Elimelech takes his family into Moab, it's questionable as to the wisdom of that. He is not long in the land, we read, before he dies. Now, we're not told of the circumstances of his death. I'm not going to say that that was a judgment upon him. But did he do a wise thing? And then we read that his two sons marry two Moabite young women. Verse 4, they take Moabite wives, one named Orpah and the other named Ruth. They marry, they settle down, and everything is reasonably fine in the family for a period of about 10 years. Naomi is a widow, but then we read that both Mahlon and Chilion die. Now here is real heartache. Here is real heartache. Naomi has come from her family home in Israel with her husband and her two sons. And within the space of 10 years, her husband's dead and her two sons are dead. And she has these two young women to care for. When someone dies in your life that's close to you, it leaves a hole. The older we are, the bigger the hole. I never met my paternal grandparents my maternal grandparents because they both died when my mother was young. My mother's mother died in childbirth, and her father died when she was barely a teenager. I do remember my paternal grandparents, but I was young when they died, and I'm going to be very honest, it made very little difference to my life. It's not that I didn't care for them. My grandfather had an issue with alcohol. My grandmother actually lived in a caravan that my father put up in the back garden to care for her in the latter years of her life. She was part of our life as a teenager. She was there. It's not that I didn't love her, but when she died, I didn't think a lot of it. In reality, the miss wasn't there. My wife's mother died in the spring of this year, and I do miss her. I miss her for a couple of reasons, as I'm sure she misses her. And I thought about that this week, and I wondered why was that the case. And I think it's just because I'm older. The relationship I had with her was a different sort of relationship that I had with my grandparents. My grandparents, I would go in with my grandmother and say, "Have you any biscuits in the cupboard?" and get a cup of tea and walk out again. That was basically it. I think as you get older, the loss of people in your life, you feel it more. This woman lost her husband and her two sons. There was the pain, obviously, of the physical contact loss. She no longer had the physical contact of her husband. The daily, just the look of the eye, the touch of the hand on the hand, maybe the arm around the shoulder. There was the physical contact with the sons. There was no sort of smile of recognition. When the sons would bring their wives home, there was no sort of looking and saying, "Do you want me to make you your special dinner?" There was a loss of protection. There was that loss of security and comfort and safety. When she was out on her own, no longer did she have her husband beside her, who would be conscious of what was happening in the environment and would be seeking to protect her. There'd be the loss of provision. There wasn't the same social benefits, obviously, as they are today. And this was a very serious thing. We know from the book of Exodus that God tells his people, "You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless. If you mistreat them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless." There was obviously an issue in Israel with exploitation, or potential issue in Israel with exploitation of widows. There were no social benefits, so women on their own had to fend for themselves. And we'll see later on this week how that God provided for that in the laws that he gave to Israel, and that was a great blessing. But that could lend itself to exploitation, because in a nation where everybody was doing what they thought best, Moab was even worse than Judah. And so there were men who would have been ruthless. They wouldn't have cared less. All they'd have been interested in was the bottom line. All they'd have been interested in was money. And a woman who was vulnerable, a woman who was insecure, she needed to feed. So she needed to go out and take whatever work there was. And they were exposed to labor and work conditions that were probably harsh and difficult. And there was nobody she could go home to at night. She couldn't go home to her husband at night and say, "You know, I had a rough day today, and I think that we need to do something about this." She couldn't go home to her sons and say, "He was harsh to me today. He was hard on me. What he said wasn't good." There was nobody she could go home to. She would just go home at night and she'd be on her own. We know that she worked in the fields, as we shall see in a moment. She speaks of this difficulty in her life later in the chapter. We didn't read it. She says, "Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me." So here is real loneliness. Here is real sadness. Here is real difficulty. Here is real hurt. Here is real pain. "Call me Mara, because the Lord has dealt with me bitterly." Came into this land probably fairly affluent, with a husband and two sons. In the space of 10 years, I have nothing. I am vulnerable. I am weak. I am broken. I am hurting. I am sad, I am sorrowful, and I have no hope. I have no hope. There is no hope for my life, in a sense. This heartache is real. It's unavoidable, it's inescapable. This loss is tangible. It's quantifiable. This loss she would have felt every day of her life. And there's a loss in every one of our lives that is even greater than this loss. There's a loss in every one of our lives which is even more tangible, runs deeper, is more hurtful than even this loss of this woman. And that's the loss of our relationship with God. For you and I were created in the image of God to live with and for God for all eternity, in the glory of His presence. You and I every day were to live and taste and see the joy of God. That's what God created man to be. Man was to have a life that was marked by privilege. Man was to get up in the morning. He was to go about his affairs. And he was to have a sense of joy in his life that could not be bettered. Every day, that sense of joy was always at the maximum. For every day, man was to share in the delight of his relationship with God. He had relationship with his wife, and that was sweet, and that was tender, and that was perfect. And then something happened. An extraordinary thing happened. A real thing happened. Something that stole that peace. Something that stole that contentment. Something that stole that joy. Something that stole that heart joy in God. And that thing that happened was Adam's decision to reject God in preference for his own way. And that is not just a mythical story at the beginning of the Bible. That's God's account to us of what actually took place in the garden in which he had placed the first man and the first woman. It's not make-believe. It is actually what happened. And the events that took place on that day when Adam took of that which God said to him, "Do not take. Show me that you love me. Show me that you delight in me. Show me that everything I have given to you is all that you need in life. And don't take of this one thing. This one thing you don't need to have. And in not taking this one thing, you're demonstrating to me that you love me with all your heart." And Adam says, "I want that one thing." And in taking that one thing, Adam said to God, "You're not enough. You're not enough. Although my days are filled with joy to the maximum, oh, my relationship with my wife is to the maximum, although I couldn't have it any better in terms of my work environment, in terms of my day-to-day living, it's not enough. I want to be the master of my own destiny. I want to decide." And on that day when Adam decided to decide for himself, it all changed. It all changed. He ran and hid from God who loved him. And he fell out with his wife. "Don't want to see you, God, because you remind me of what I had and what I've lost. It's not my fault, it's her fault. It's her fault. She's the one to blame. Previously, they lived in beautiful harmony. Now it was a case of he couldn't get to blame her quick enough, and she couldn't get to blame him quick enough. And that's the heartache that we all are conceived into. That's the heartache of each of our lives. The loss of our lives is the loss of this relationship with God. And that underscores every moment of every hour of our living. Everything in our lives is marked or affected by that loss of that relationship with God. The fact that you and I never ever have a day where we're completely filled with happiness and joy, even those of us who believe in God and love Jesus Christ, the fact that we never ever have a day when we're completely filled with joy is because of the loss of that relationship. You have no peace. You can't put your pillow down, your head in the pillow at night time. You have no peace. There's an anger deep within you. Your face may be placid and you be meek and mild, but the reality that there's a storm brewing inside you. There's a hurricane, a whirlwind of activity, a cyclone that eats at your heart and your mind, and you're within a hair's breadth of occasions of erupting, but you just manage to keep it in. Occasionally it seeps out. Where is that resentment coming from? Where is that bitterness? Where is that hatred? And often isn't it geared to ones that we say we love the most? We don't do it with the people that we don't say we love. The ones that we love get the brunt of our anger. The ones that we love get the brunt of the whirlwind. The ones that we really, really love, deep down love, they're the ones that have to listen to the words that come from our tongues. It makes no sense. It's unrational, irrational. And the reason for it is because we're angry at the loss of this relationship with God. We can't cope with the loss of it. We can't cope with the smashed peace and the lack of contentment. Heartache's real. What then, briefly, do we see as the first stage in the move to joy? What's the first stage? Well, we read in verse 6 that whenever Naomi is in the fields, she hears something. She hears that the Lord has visited his people and given them food. She hears that God has visited Israel and is blessing them again. There are a number of occasions in the Bible where God talks about visiting. Time constrains me from going through what I prepared. But the Lord visited Sarah, who was without child, and she conceived and bore Abraham a son. Joseph talks to his brothers prior to his death about a time the Lord would visit. Psalm 65, the psalm that we sang, although we didn't sing through the ninth verse, speaks of the Lord visiting the earth and watering it and greatly enriching it. And here Naomi hears that the Lord God has visited the land of Israel. He has come again. He had come in judgment and he had delivered famine. He had seen their rebellion. He had seen their evil. And he said, I have got to stop this. Do you know sometimes God brings visitation in our life of hardship? Do you know why he brings that visitation of hardship? I've heard people say to me, surely if God is a God of love, he wouldn't allow that to happen. He wouldn't let that happen if he was a real God of love. Do you know why he lets that happen? Because of his love. Well, what sense does that make? Where did that come from? How can God, of a God of love, bring hardship upon our lives? Well, we need hardship at times to be awakened to the reality of our lives. We're in difficulties at times because of our rebellion against God. And what God does is he pours more hardship on us. Why? Because he wants to bring us to the brink of despair. He wants to bring us to our knees. He wants to virtually break us. Why does he want to bring us to the brink of despair, to our knees, to break us? Because he then wants to visit us and say, I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. But now you listen. Before you wouldn't listen. Because you thought it was this little hardship and you wanted me to come and dress it up. And I would dress it up and I would patch it up and you would go on with your life. And you wouldn't think about me. And you wouldn't worry about me. And I'd be no consequence to you. I'd have no impact on your life. And you would just go on and you would just go on and just you would go on. Well, God says, I don't want part of your love. I want all of your love. I don't want you to come in at tea time and say, I've met so-and-so and I've had a good chat and we had a good chat over dinner and I'm going to take her. Don't want that. I want all of your love. And he says, I want all of your love because you need all of my love. You need all of my love. You need all of my love. And I want you to taste all of my love. And so I've given you this to stop you in your tracks. I've given you this to bring you to me. I've given you this heartache. And here is Naomi with the loss of her husband and her two sons in this foreign land. And she hears the Lord has come to Israel. The famine is gone. The seed is in the ground. It has germinated. The God has caused it to rise. The harvest has been taken. The Amalekites and the Moabites have been restrained, and now there is plenty in Israel. The Lord visits. And that's what we need in our lives. And that's the first stage to joy. The first stage in the journey to joy from heartache is the experience of heartache. It's the experience of heartache. It's the coming face to face with the reality of our loss of our relationship with God. And then we're in a position where we're prepared and ready for God to come and speak to us. Many times in our lives have we had the opportunity to do the right thing, and we haven't chosen to do it. Because we weren't on our knees. When God brings heartache, he brings it for a reason. It's to bring us to him. And oh, that God would visit your soul tonight. That he would visit your soul. That he would visit your heart and your mind. That God would visit you. That God would visit you. And that you would hear like Naomi. And you'd respond like Naomi. And turn to the place of blessing that God has. Naomi heard in the field. And then she turned to the place of blessing in Israel. You can't walk from heartache to joy unless you first face the heartache and the source of that heartache. You can't then take the first stage on the route, the journey to joy, until you've pleaded with God to visit with you, to visit with you, and to open your eyes to see him and to hear him, and to see the prospect of blessing that he can bring upon your life. Will you come back tomorrow night and hear the next stage and hear what God does in the life of this woman and her two daughters? For this is instructive to your soul. To your soul. There's much you hear on a day-to-day basis, but probably not of a lot of it deals with your soul. And not a lot of it addresses the matter of your eternal existence. May God bless his word to us all. Amen.